This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with former Major League Baseball pitcher Bob Ojeda. But first, Jeff Daniels. He stars in the new HBO series, The Newsroom. It was created by Aaron Sorkin, who also created The West Wing and wrote the movie The Social Network. Jeff Daniels has been in many films, including Terms of Endearment, The Purple Rose of Cairo, Dumb and Dumber, and The Squid and the Whale. In HBO's The Newsroom, Daniels plays Will McAvoy, the anchor of a cable news show who pledges to cover stories because they're important, not because they get ratings. That's his attitude after a transformation. When The Newsroom begins, Will McAvoy has a bland, vanilla broadcasting persona. In the opening scene of the series, McAvoy's part of a university panel discussion with a liberal and a conservative about the news media. McAvoy is evasive and makes jokes as he answers the moderator's questions. He doesn't get serious until the audience Q&A session, when a student asks McAvoy what makes America the best country in the world. His answer shocks everyone.
Why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying...
Yes.
Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser.
Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of our paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it anytime he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is there is absolutely no evidence.
That's Jeff Daniels in a scene from the new HBO series, The Newsroom. Jeff Daniels, welcome back to Fresh Air. So how much cable news did you watch before starting to go into production for The Newsroom?
In regards to research for the show, none. Zero. I mean, I've been watching
Why?
I'd been kind of a political news junkie, cable news junkie, since I think about the 2000 election. I think that's when I really kind of clicked into that 24/7 kind of news cycle thing that they do. But to actually research the role, I didn't research anybody.
Because?
Well, Aaron never brought it up. I mean, Aaron never said, by the way, this is based on so-and-so.
So-and-so being everybody speculating. It's Keith Olbermann. I guess Sorkin and Olbermann are friends, and Sports Night, one of Sorkin's earlier shows, was about the kind of sports show that Olbermann used to co-host.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah. But no. He certainly knows Keith. He knows Chris Matthews. He knows all these guys. Larry O'Donnell, I think, was a consultant on West Wing.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Sure.
So he's aware of all these guys. And they certainly, Aaron and Alan Poole, the producers, certainly did a lot of research hanging out, scouting, say, like the CNN newsroom, and to get, a set replica and things like that. But When they brought me on, no one ever dropped a name saying, you know, him, follow him, be him. It was more, let's create our own guy and see if we can't fictionalize somebody, but make it feel like to the audience that, you know, after you see an episode or two or three, that you can imagine this guy and this network and this news program being dropped in the middle of MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. And that's kind of how we approached it.
So one of the things I enjoy about your new series, The Newsroom, part of the drama is about booking the right guests. And because we book guests on our show, it's like, yeah, that's what life is about, booking guests. And it's
just
exciting to see a drama about booking guests. But don't you have the reverse feeling? Now that you're doing that fictionally, don't you really want to watch cable news and see who the guests end up being and how well the interview goes?
I have a much greater appreciation for all of the shows and all of the guys on either side of that cable news aisle politically, what they deal with. And when they get their go-to guests, the people that come in on a regular basis, and you almost know what they're going to say before they say it. And when they get that new guy, that kind of rogue guest that comes in and kind of goes off message, or which allows a Chris Matthews or a Sean Hannity or whomever to kind of pounce, I can see it in their eyes. It's interesting to have done the show to know pretty much what's being whispered in their ear by the producer in the middle of an interview, to know that when they go off on Sarah Palin, depending on which show you're watching, that's either going to be good for ratings or bad for ratings. And they know before they even hit a subject like that whether they're going to get a spike or not.
So I'm wondering if you ever agree with the kind of thing your character says. Like, for example, he gives an editorial on one of his broadcasts, and this is in episode 3, in which he plays a clip of Richard Clark, who's in the Bush and Clinton administrations in counterterrorism, apologizing to the American public for not having prevented 9/11. And then you come on and say that, you know, you appreciated that apology, and now you're going to apologize to the American public. And here's your apology.
Good evening. I'm Will McAvoy. This is Newsnight. And that was a clip of Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief to President George W. Bush, testifying before Congress on March 24th, 2004. Americans liked that moment. I liked that moment. Adults should hold themselves accountable for failure. And so tonight, I'm beginning this newscast by joining Mr. Clark and apologizing to the American people for our failure, the failure of this program during the time I've been in charge of it, to successfully inform and educate the American electorate. Let me be clear that I don't apologize on behalf of all broadcast journalists, nor do all broadcast journalists owe an apology. I speak for myself. I was an accomplice to a slow and repeated and unacknowledged and unamended train wreck of failures that have brought us to now. I'm a leader in an industry that miscalled election results, hyped up terror scares, ginned up controversy, and failed to report on tectonic shifts in our country, from the collapse of the financial system to the truths about how strong we are to the dangers we actually face. I'm a leader in an industry that misdirected your attention.
So that was Jeff Daniels in a scene from episode 3 of the new HBO series, The Newsroom. So how do you react to what he said in that clip? Do you agree with some of the things that he said about how the media hypes terror scares and takes a dive for the ratings?
Yeah, I think there are we had a screening last night in New York, and it was like a who's who of the New York national media from all the networks. And doing a little cocktail reception before the show, I was talking with a lot of journalists, and a lot of these guys would say, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years. And I remember when Sadat did this, and, you know, I was there in Afghanistan. And you're talking to these guys, and they're about to see a show that doesn't call them out, but just reminds them that, you know, by the way, there is journalism, there is real journalism, and then there is that spin. There is that thing that the cable news shows will do that plays to their audience, that they know they have to come down on this side of the issue in order to keep that audience tuned in tonight. And Aaron will tell you he's an idealist. He's a romanticist. He thinks that there is a place for truth in journalism. There is a place for these ideals and to hang on to those. I mean, we are basically making a show about what they've spent their lives doing. And many of them came up afterwards and were very complimentary and were very relieved, I think. It was funny. A lot of them wanted it to be based on them, the character of Will McAvoy. I hope you're basing it on me, but I also hope you're not basing it on me. They were confused. It was nice to see national-owned journalists in a state of kind of confusion.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Daniels, and he stars in the new HBO series, The Newsroom. So in The Newsroom, you do your share of monologues on and off the air.
Sure.
But you also do a lot of duets, as I think of them, where, like, you're with another character and you have a little showdown or a little, you know, a conflict of some sort. And so, like, you know, the dialogue is very kind of rapid fire, witty, sometimes, you know, very dense because there's a lot of content to it, too. And I thought I'd play an example of one of your, you know, quote, duets. This is from episode 1. After you've kind of shocked everybody at a symposium at the Northwestern University campus, you shocked everyone by actually giving your opinion, and your opinion was that America really isn't like the best place in the world, the most democratic place in the world. And then you start criticizing things that are wrong with America. But anyway, so you go on a 3-week hiatus after that. And when you return to your show, you find out that your executive producer has left for another show and he's taken the rest of the staff with him. And you're shocked and you're angry. So this is your showdown with that executive producer. His name is Don Kiefer, and he's played by Thomas Sadowski. And also in the scene is Sam Waterston, who plays the president of the news division at your cable channel. And the executive producer speaks first.
I tried to get in touch with you, but Charlie said...
You asked to leave?
I did, but we have 2 weeks before Elliot
showed. Because what happened?
No.
Because the second half was a rousing call.
It has nothing to do with what happened.
Timing is curious.
Didn't you tell him it doesn't have anything to do with what happened?
Yes, and talk to him when you're talking to him.
After all the time we spent working side by side.
I've been your EP for 13 weeks.
That's the longest I've ever worked with anybody. I mean, you were the one. You were my guy. We were like the Everly Brothers.
You'll interview some good candidates.
No, please, I'll replace you in 15 minutes.
You know, it wasn't the any American thing, Will, or even that you aimed a profanity-laced tirade at a college sophomore.
She's talking about suing the university for mental anguish.
Talking about it to who?
Mostly Kathy Lee and Hoda.
Guess who her lawyer is?
If you say Gloria Allred.
It's your personality.
What?
The reason I'm leaving and the reason the others are.
I'm affable!
To strangers, to people who watch you on TV, you yelled at me in front of the crew.
That's what this is about.
That's what this is about.
Yeah, you know, I thought you were talking into my ear.
That's what I'm supposed to do.
I had Stanley McChrystal on satellite from Kandahar. He's being shot at by the Taliban, and you were yakking in my ear.
I wasn't yakking. I was telling you not to let him off the hook.
Was that something that really needed to be said 4 times?
Yeah, because you let him off the hook, as was pointed out by everyone with internet access. You blew that interview, and you took it out on
me. It was 2 days after the thing with the student. I thought it would be a good idea to show deference to a 3-star.
You took it out on me. You did it in front of the staff. Then you took it out on the staff the way you're doing right
now. The staff isn't here! You're taking the department heads. Who the hell knows who they're taking?
Okay, so that's Jeff Daniels along with Thomas Sadowski in a scene from episode 1 of The Newsroom, the new HBO series. The student referred to in that scene is the student who asked the question that leads to the long and opinionated answer that your character gives that so astonishes everybody. And her question was something like, in one sentence or less, what makes America the best country in the world? But anyways, that's a perfect example of you uncorking, but also it's an example of the kind of overlapping dialogue that Sorkin so often writes. And I'm wondering if that's scripted in, if that's kind of scored in the pages that you get, where you can see exactly where you're supposed to be speaking over the other character, and the other character sees where he's supposed to be speaking over you.
Yeah, almost to the letter. And also we're encouraged. There are times where they go, real good, now just overlap a little bit more. And they kind of leave it up to us. They want it to feel real. They want it to feel like these two guys are having an argument in the hallway and 3 cameras just happen to be watching. That's what Aaron wants. And Aaron's not the first to invent this kind of pace, this kind of... You know, Mamet does it, and you go to a Broadway show where the dialogue moves. Movies like Preston Sturges movies, you know, Kaufman and Hart, Billy Wilder. People, there's pace, and with that pace is the music. That's where there's a rhythm to it. It's almost musical. You could almost go back through that clip and hear the word hook. Let him off the hook. Let him off the hook. Those are almost drum beats that builds to a certain kind of climax. I mean, that if you do it at the proper pace, it sings. It also, the interesting thing about the overlapping dialogue and that rhythm and that pace is that that's kind of a verbal car chase. I mean, this isn't an action series. This isn't, you know, we aren't, you know, pulling guns and, you know, cars coming around corners. But we do go after each other, and when done properly at the right pace, and it can be very compelling, almost like an action sequence.
What's it like for you as an actor, memorizing all this, you know, pretty dense, rapid-fire dialogue, and not having the rehearsal and prep time that you'd have if you were doing it on stage? And if you were doing it on stage, you'd be doing the same thing every night and it would become second nature eventually. You don't get that opportunity.
No, and you're doing the same lines every night. We get a new play, basically, 90 pages every 2 weeks.
What's your technique for memorizing?
I've got to just... walk through it. I memorize it like a grocery list. Bland. Alan Arkin taught me that. I did a TV thing with Alan. He directed it. He'd always been a hero of mine. And he said, let's do a reading. Let's read the script and just read it flat like a grocery list. No choices, nothing. I don't want anything and nothing. Just read it as boringly and as blandly as possible. And that's one thing that helps me is if I learn it blandly, vanilla, then I don't try to act it too soon. Because you start to act it and you kind of go away from what the next sentence is, what the next paragraph is. So get it down so it kind of can, it's in there, so you can then, as I call it, dance on top of it. You got to know it before you can dance on top of it and make it sound like it's something falling out of this guy's head instead of off of a page.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Jeff Daniels. In the 2005 film The Squid and the Whale, Daniels plays Professor Bernard Berkman. He's a character who sees himself as a great writer, but unfortunately just can't seem to get his next book written. Berkman's the kind of person who defines everyone according to their artistic talent or literary merit. In this scene from The Squid and the Whale, he's playing ping pong with his younger son, who's played by Owen Klein.
19-7. Have you given more thought to what you're interested in? Come on. You have to try. It's no fun for me if you don't try.
I want to be a tennis pro like Ivan.
Oh, come on. You don't want to be a tennis pro.
Why not?
It's not serious. I mean, McEnroe. Borg is an artist. It's like dance. Connors has a brutish brilliance, but at Ivan's level, Ivan is fine, but he's not a serious guy. He's a Philistine.
What's a Philistine?
It's a guy who doesn't care about books or interesting films and things. Your mother's brother, Ned, is also a Philistine.
Then I'm a Philistine.
No, you're interested in books and things. You liked The Wild Child when we saw it.
But lots of people like that movie. No, I'm a Philistine.
That's my guest, Jeff Daniels, with Owen Klein in a scene from The Squid and the Whale. I felt like I knew your character.
You know? Oh, he's out there.
Yeah, he's out there. He's very recognizable to me, and I'm sure you've known him too. 'Cause that character not only lives in English departments, he lives in theaters and I'm sure in movie sets as well. So who did you draw on for that, like, very self-absorbed, really pretentious character?
I had written plays. I have a theater company in Michigan, the Purple Rose Theater Company. And over the last 20 years or so, I've written, you know, 15 plays. So I knew the writer's life. I knew that solitary existence. I knew about writing something and then not being appreciated or not having, you know, not being, you know, heralded like you think you should be. There was that. I get sent books that were self-published, and usually for a reason. And here's a book I self-published that I wrote that you're perfect for. Could you give it to Spielberg? And so it's not a big leap to know who that guy is, brilliant in his own universe. You know, the world revolves around his brilliance. And if only everyone would just catch up. It's not too hard to kind of create that guy, you know, on your own.
Another film I want to ask you about is Blood Work, which was directed by Clint Eastwood, who also starred in it as, what was he, a former FBI agent who'd had, like, heart problems, but now he's investigating a murder, and you're one of the people involved in the story. You end up being the villain.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah. So you got to see the two Clint Eastwoods at the same time, director Clint Eastwood and detective Clint Eastwood. What was the difference between the two Clint Eastwoods? I mean, one was out to kill you.
One had a gun.
Yes.
The, I'd heard about it, but couldn't believe it when I saw it. It's usually one take, and he hired you for a reason, because you're good. And so I want you to do it the way you think it should be done. Go. And you do the one take. It goes, good. Thank you. And moves the camera. And you're going, wow. I mean, if an actor ever wanted to control his performance and they're only getting one take, that's the way to do it. He's so supportive. I remember asking him before the movie started, some wardrobe question or something. I said, should it be the blue jacket or the brown jacket? He goes, you're the actor. I go, the brown one. Sounds like the brown one. And that was it. I said, okay, I've got it. And he couldn't have been more supportive and nicer and easier, the easiest set to be on ever. And interestingly, Clint Eastwood in capital letters, that guy, it was fascinating as an actor to sit off camera. We're driving in a car up a road, and he's in the passenger seat. I'm driving. And it's doing his close-up, and I can see him just kind of being Clint, in his 70s, the director, and he looks back at the camera guy and says, are you ready? And yes, sir. All right, here we go. And I could see him just come up into it and become Clint Eastwood. He knew exactly where to hold his head, how to lay the speech out, and then he'd get to the end of the speech or the scene, and he'd go, all right, that's enough of that. And it would go away. I'd seen that before with Cagney. My first film was Ragtime, back in 81, maybe. James Cagney was in his early 80s, and Milos Forman wanted him for the role of the police commissioner. And they brought us in to a studio in New York City, and they had Cagney come down from his farm in upstate New York. Cagney didn't think he could do it. And they brought him in. He had a nurse with him, and he was coming in on a walker. And he sat down at a table, and they were just going to read the scene. Cagney wanted a screen test just to see if he could do it. And Milos was so in his corner. And it was a 4-page scene, and he just, God bless him, he couldn't do it. And it was a 3-page. Then Milos cut it to 2 pages. Then he cut it down to 1 page with 4 lines. And after about half an hour, with this very old actor sitting there, wishing, trying to will himself into doing it, he finally got on top of those 4 lines. And you could see it on the little black and white monitor up on the screen back in the early 80s there. He became Cagney. You could see that old guy, that old image, that old star behind all those years in the eyes. You could see it. And Milos, cut, good, you're doing the role. That was it. Same thing with Clint.
What's the lesson in that for you? I mean, to watch them become the icon that they are.
I think it's a style of acting that you trust. You trust the instincts. Meryl Streep's brilliant at it, just brilliant. I've been fortunate to do 2 movies with Meryl. And for an actor to go moment to moment like she does, there's no one better. And she dances between moments. Each take is different because she's riding instincts. She's riding impulses. And she trusts that. She doesn't try to plan everything out ahead of time, or she doesn't do a take and hold herself back. She risks failure, and she allows herself to kind of be open to wherever it goes. And that's what I saw these guys do, is just relax and kind of become that and then see and ride it. And they would ride that image they had created over the years, or ride that feeling that happens between action and cut. It's a different style of acting. We did that on Newsroom because there were so many cameras, you never knew where the camera was. So why don't you just risk failure and jump off the cliff and start flapping your arms and hope you fly? It's a very exciting way to work. And through the wonderful world of editing, they'll save you every time.
So a question about Dumb and Dumber. You start in that with Jim Carrey.
I love on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, we're talking about Dumb and Dumber.
Why not?
This is beautiful. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
So Jim Carrey is like great at physical comedy and pratfalls and stuff. That's not your thing, although you've done really good physical comedy, like even in The Answer Man, which was an independent film. There's some very funny physical comedy in that because your back always hurt. Oh, I have to say, as someone who has had back pain, I love the way you walked and stuff when your back hurt.
Sure. I think I was actually on my hands and knees crawling to a chiropractor through the streets of Philadelphia where we shot the
film.
There
was that
scene,
yes.
There are scenes, yes.
But you weren't always in that bad pain, but.
And because it was an independent picture, there was no security. So I'm crawling amongst real Philadelphians who are looking down at, what's the guy from Dumb and Dumber doing crawling on the floors, crossing the street? Oh, well.
You know, there was parts of where you shot wasn't far from where we do our radio show in Philadelphia. So there were parts of the neighborhood that were like closed off or like, did you hear they're shooting it at that bookstore, you know, on 2nd Street? I was like, whoa, really? They're shooting it there? But but anyways, back to Dumb and Dumber. So in Dumb and Dumber, you're with Jim Carrey, who specializes in physical comedy in pratfalls. What's the most, like, physically challenging thing you had to do in that film?
In Dumb and Dumber?
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, certainly the toilet scene was a challenge.
Yes, it was humiliation challenge?
Well, as I told Pete Farrelly, the director, he and Bobby, before the scene started, I said, well, this is either the beginning of my career or the end of it. And no, it's going to be great, man. Here's what you do. And so we got on there. And I think the actual act of what happens on the toilet, I think they had cut it down to about 30 seconds, but there were takes that were two and a half minutes long of just pure agony of what was going on in that action. And so there were times, and I think there's even one close-up where I'm pushing so hard that the blood in my head, you know, it can happen when you get all the blood, and I almost passed out, almost fell off the toilet. And I think, I'm pretty sure they used that shot. So yeah, that was, physically, that was, the career was at a crossroads when that scene was finished, yeah.
How much trust do you have to have in the Farrelly brothers to do a scene like that that could end up being not only humiliating but not funny? I mean, you don't know if it's going to be funny, really, until you see it.
Well, and Jim will tell you the same thing. We know where funny is. You know, we didn't get where we got without guessing right a lot or having that instinct of where the laugh is. So that's, but it's film. I mean, we're not going to find out if a general audience laughs for a year. So there's that. But so you're at the mercy of whoever's cutting it. We have comic timing. We know that. You're born with it. That's not something you can teach. But once you've got it and you know it, okay, that's the rhythm of it. That's where funny is. Great. And if they stay in a two shot, then you control it. If they start cutting back and forth, then you just have to trust that the directors and the editors have comic timing as well, and you know, certainly they did, and certainly the Farrelly brothers do. So it was easy to trust. But I've always found that the great comedians are fearless. You know, great film comedians like Peter Sellers, and you can go back to, my God, Keaton and Charlie Chaplin. I mean, they will do anything, and then cut it later and edit it later, and it's just a take. Go on. I mean, if you're holding back, then you're probably not going to find funny.
So in Michigan, you started the Purple Rose Theater Company. You've written plays for the company. You've of course been in productions and performed there. What did it bring out in you to basically have a theater company in which you could do things that you probably couldn't have done in other people's theater companies?
I think when I came to New York in the 70s, I was writing songs, and I was already a writer, and I didn't know I was a writer. So when I opened the Purple Rose Theater Company in 91, I wanted to learn how to be a playwright. And at my own theater company, hiring professionals who live in Michigan, who went to New York, didn't make it, or this was their professional creative home, it also allowed me to develop as a playwright, which completely informed me as an actor because I understood writing. So that now that I'm on the newsroom, I know what Aaron's doing. I know what he's intending. I know what he's up against. I know what this scene means. The craft of it has been a big help to my acting.
Jeff Daniels stars in the new HBO drama, The Newsroom. You'll find the longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new Pixar film, Brave. And former Major League pitcher Bob Ojeda talks about the glory and the pain of pitching. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The movie Brave is the latest feature from Pixar Animation Studios, and it's the studio's first feature with a female protagonist, a medieval Scottish princess named Merida, who asserts her independence and causes havoc. Kelly MacDonald does the voice of Merida, and the cast includes Billy Connolly and Emma Thompson. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
First, I hate the title, and not because it's an adjective. Notorious, ravenous, rabid, great titles. Brave, generic. And with the poster of a girl with flame-red curls pulling back a bow, it looks like yet another female warrior saga, another you-go-girl action picture, suggesting the biggest injustice to women over the last millennium has been the suppression of their essential warlike natures. You'd hardly know this latest Pixar movie is a broad comedy, a farce, and that it centers not just on the redhead who wants to shoot arrows, but the mom who constantly undermines her. It's closer to the uproarious Freaky Friday than the recent glumly revisionist Snow White picture, and all the more delightful for it. Now, the first part of the film is a bit misleading. After a prologue in which the huge medieval Scottish king Fergus goes nose to snout with a giant bear, Brave depicts his daughter, Merida, growing up and longing to head out. She wants to shoot arrows like her dad, to chase the wind and touch the sky, as proclaimed in a Celtic-inflected song on the soundtrack called, Touch the Sky. But then the central conflict emerges. Merida, who teases her dad for constantly declaiming the bear who took his leg story to anyone who will listen, and who walks around with a longbow, and the mom, who wants her to act like a stereotypical princess. In this scene, Kelly MacDonald is the voice of Merida, the wonderful Scottish comedian Billy Connolly, King Fergus, and Emma Thompson, Queen Eleanor.
Out of nowhere, the biggest bear you've ever seen, his hide littered with the weapons of fallen warriors, his face scarred with one dead eye. I drew my sword, and...
Once swipe, his sword shattered, then chomp! Dad's leg was clean off. Down the monster's throat it went.
Oh, that's my favorite part.
Mordu has never been seen since, and is roaming the wilds, waiting his chance of revenge.
Let him return. I'll finish what I guddled in the first place.
A princess does not place her weapons on the table.
Mom!
That hearty Scottish verbal attack splendidly evokes a film in which all the people are wayward, headlong, acting before thinking. After Merida humiliates three ludicrous suitors from three different clans competing for her hand, she gallops off and sees a magical glowing orb called a will-o'-the-wisp that leads her to the house of an enterprising witch who sells her a spell. I can't tell you what that spell does. It's a major spoiler. But the rest of Brave consists of Merida trying to undo it and prevent a potentially fatal disaster. The film has three directors, Mark Andrews, Brenda Chapman, and Steve Purcell, and my Tam O'Shanter is off to them for a second half in which farce, suspense, and surprising sentiment are in perfect balance. You can detect the influence of the great Japanese animation director Hayao Miyazaki in those will-o'-the-wisps, and in the central idea of a misunderstood child who wishes a parent would change and then has to use all her wits and strength when the parent changes too much. But Brave is pure Pixar in its mischievousness and irreverence and the brilliantly delineated facial movements of its characters, with Kelly MacDonald an inspired choice for Merida, her voice both melodious and edged with exasperation. Some Hollywood commentators have pointed to the previews for Brave and the recent poorly received Cars 2 to wonder if Pixar is losing its edge and becoming more formulaic. True, Brave is not as groundbreaking as the last two Toy Story pictures, Finding Nemo or Ratatouille. but it's fast, funny, and unpretentious, its message more powerful for its lack of stridency. Merida wants nothing more than to control her own fate, her rage provoked by her mother's refusal to see the world through her eyes. Her cataclysmic attempt to change her mother's mind at least has the effect of giving them both a common cause, and spares Merida the kind of estrangement that nowadays would lead to thousands of dollars in therapy.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new animated film, Brave. Fresh Air is produced in Philadelphia. Since 2007, our baseball team, the Phillies, has finished the regular season in first place in their division, the NL East. In 2008 and 2009, the Phillies even made it to the World Series, winning the championship in 2008. But this year, as we approach the halfway point of the regular season, the Phillies are struggling to get out of last place in their division. Part of the Phillies' problem is that so many key players are on the disabled list, among them Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, and Roy Halladay. Lots of athletes live with pain, but they don't necessarily talk about it. Last month, our guest Bob Ojeda wrote an article in the New York Times called My Left Arm. It's all about the pain he dealt with as a major league pitcher. Ojeda was part of the 1986 World Series championship Mets team. He also pitched for the Boston Red Sox, the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Cleveland Indians, and the New York Yankees. Bob Ojeda is now the pre- and post-game analyst for the Mets. He spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Bob Ojeda, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
So you were basically always in pain. Is that typical for a pitcher?
I think, by and large, a lot of guys experience different levels of pain or discomfort or just uneasiness with an arm or a leg or a knee or a back or a neck. Pitching is an all-encompassing motion. And I think a lot has to do with genetics. But I would say by and large, because of the act itself is sort of violent and completely unnatural, I think most pitchers certainly feel a certain level of pain and whatnot.
Violent and unnatural. So here's what I'd like you to do, if you could do this. If you could kind of take us through a pitch, just through all the motions of a pitch, and tell us what it's doing to your arm as you go through the motion.
Okay. Well, what you do is I'll go right from the beginning. I mean, I'm looking down at my catcher. He gives me a sign. I okay the sign. I step on the rubber. And I begin my turn, my motion, my entire delivery. The whole idea is you're throwing with your entire body. And then you lift your leg, you turn, and all, you know, there's a million different deliveries. But the part that most of us have in common is your hand and your arm goes up well above your shoulder, and that's where the unnaturalness of it comes. And then you have to deliver that pitch forward with whatever effort physically that you're able to use that day. The trick to the whole thing is your front side. You do not want your front side to fly out too soon, your glove hand side. If that does, when you see a pitcher's front side go a little too soon, take a notice of his arm, his shoulder, the one that has the arm attached to the ball, and you'll see a tremendous amount of separation there where the arm is completely behind the whole front part of his body. And at that point, that's the probably the most dangerous point of the delivery. Before you deliver it, front foot has landed, and you are now, you know, driving and torquing towards home. The key is to not let your arm with the ball in it drag too far behind, because that's when that shoulder opens up and injury is a viable option right then.
So what was the pitch that strained your arm the most? I don't mean the individual pitch. I mean the type of pitch.
For me, it was the fastball, because that required the most energy. That was the one that put the maximum wow factor in the ow, if you will.
And what was the pitch that you could most easily fall back on bad days when you were in pain?
My go-to was the changeup. That was one that the delivery is exactly the same, but their power, you know, the energy that I was talking about earlier is completely devoid. That's the trick to that pitch. The motion has to be the same, but I just have to remove all the power from that thing. And that, in that case, it would hurt the least. Sliders can be very nasty on an elbow. Curveballs can have that same effect in the elbow. But I would say, by and large, the fastball is the most painful if you misfire.
So do you think batters could read whether you were in pain and therefore which pitch you'd be throwing?
Well, that's a very good question. That's the trick, is to, I have to throw all my pitches on any given day and not let him know what's going on. There's a lot of recon going on in how I even how I do my warm-up pitches in between innings. Believe me, they're noticing, wow, he's not throwing this in his warm-up pitches, because I'm on the mound in front of the other team during the game. So they note all that stuff. Well, he's backed off on this. As the game progresses, they'll notice if you've backed off on a certain pitch, and they'll adjust their approach to you accordingly. So a part of the beauty of the game is I have to constantly keep trying to trick them as much physically as I do mentally. I have to let them know that, no, I've got all my weapons today, so you better pay attention to all of them.
So take us back to 1986, Game 6 of the National League Championship Series. You were pitching for the Mets against the Astros, and you'd pitched a complete game in a 5-1 victory over the Astros, and your arm really hurt. And the doctor said that your only option was a shot. So tell us what happened.
Well, at that point, well, you know, I threw the game in Houston, then we came back, and I was scheduled to throw a bullpen. You pitch your game, and then you usually take a day off or two and then throw a bullpen session. That's where you practice out beyond the wall there. We have a whole mound set up. And for me, it was at a point where that session just wasn't going to happen. If I got through it, I don't recall exactly if I got through it. I probably did, because I was still I could not let on to anyone other than that circle of myself, my trainer, and my team doctor, the only three who knew anything. So I probably, you know, went through my session and, you know, said, yeah, no, I'm fine. Everything's good. But after that, I confided with the trainer that we got to do something. And that was when the plan by the doctor was for me to go down and meet him in Washington and get the shot, because that was the only thing left at that time. I'd never taken any pills other than anti-inflammatories. And there's, at that point, I'd already tried quite a few different ones, and I was just about out of rope. So the only thing left was the cortisone in the elbow.
So how much did it help?
And once I did it, it didn't feel a whole lot better. But then when I started to throw in the bullpen in Houston to get loose, it literally felt, and this was a sensation I'll never forget, it felt like sandbags were inserted in my elbow. It just was this added product in there, and it just took a while to get it out of there. The first inning, it was in there, and I really couldn't make the ball do what I needed it to do. After that, it literally began to just dissipate through there, and eventually it felt much better. By the time I was out of that game, I believe fifth or sixth inning, I felt it had been a success. That shot worked for me. Now, they're not long-term solutions. We knew that going in. I knew that going in. This is a temporary fix to alleviate the pain in that area and to, you know, help clear things out, I guess. I'm not an authority on cortisone, but whatever it was intended to do, whatever it was supposed to do, it worked for me, at least temporarily.
But here's the thing. It always seems like it's a trade-off. Like, if you get the shot and it works for you temporarily so you could go back in the game, are you trading off long-term the ability of your arm to actually really heal?
Potentially. But at that point, this little guy from that town in California, growing up with a dad who, this was his dream and my dream as well, I'd pay that price any day of the week. And I did.
To be in the series and keep pitching.
Oh, gosh, yeah. At that point, you could not have kept me out of there. I'd have done anything. I'd have done anything and accepted the consequences. I didn't do them, and then, you know, years later, oh, you know, why'd I do that? No, I did them fully conscious of what I was doing and what I was risking, but it was worth the risk. I got a chance to go to the World Series. This is my dream since I was a little guy making up my own uniform when I was 5 years old, because I love the game so much. So no, there was nothing I wouldn't have done legally to stay out of those games.
So how did you do and how did the Mets do in the series?
We did pretty good. We did pretty good. I had the biggest game of my life after that game in Houston, after the shot. We were down two, went to Boston, and I threw a great game. Seven innings, I didn't give up anything. So that was by far the greatest game I ever pitched, the most emotional game I'd ever been in, not knowing what was ahead of us, but I knew at that particular point, we lose game three, and we're in deep trouble.
So what do you do when you're on the injured list? How do you spend your time outside of physical therapy? And how does it feel to watch the game that you can't play in?
It's brutal. It is like being on the outside looking in, and there's a party going on, and they can't see you, they can't hear you. You're invisible, and you feel invisible, and part of you doesn't want to be seen or heard because you're not a part of it. You're not able to go out there and be a part of it. Good, bad, or ugly, you're not a part of it. So it's an awful place to be, the disabled list. It's terrible, but it actually drives you to get back out there, and the sooner I could get back, the better. That was why I began my rehab as soon as possible. And originally it was 3 days a week, and I told the lady, I said, no, we're doing this 5 days a week, 7 days a week, whatever it takes. So I really pushed the envelope to get back because it was for my own selfish reasons. I didn't like being on the outside at all.
How did it go when you went back?
I wound up coming back in September. I threw a couple games. I think I started a couple. And it did not feel good, but it was a different kind of pain. It wasn't that same. It wasn't that locking thing that was going on. So I knew the end of the season was there. There again, I said earlier, I can tough it out for three or four starts or what have you, knowing that winter was right around the corner, and that was my thing. I just had to get back out there before going through another winter with the question mark of is this going to work? So as much as it hurt, I still knew it worked. I still knew original type pain I'd been having was gone. It was a new pain, but I just attributed that to, obviously, the surgery and all that.
How did you know it was time to end your baseball career?
Emotionally, I was done. Emotionally, my shoulder was shot. I knew potentially another surgery was on tap, and I just didn't want to do it anymore. I reached a point where, for me, I had to be all in, and that all in was 100%. I had to want to get you out 100%. Once I lost that, 2% of that, I was done. I didn't have that burning desire to get you out that I needed to, and the end came emotionally before the end came physically.
So, does your arm still hurt?
Yes. It does, but I don't gotta try to throw a baseball anymore. Ironically, when I would coach, I coached with a good friend of mine, Rich Gedman. I would throw a bullpen for fun with him. We're old. This was, 6-7 years ago. You know, it's something you miss being able to do, but it's something that I've moved on from because it's just life.
Bob Ojeda is a former Mets pitcher who is now the team's pre- and post-game analyst. You'll find the longer version of his conversation with Terry, as well as a link to his recent New York Times article on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.